to the tensions bubbling up today between the White House and the CIA over a still unreleased Senate report reportedly condemning the CIA's actions after 9/11. Couple of ticks in this story. First, today the CIA admitted that its officers improperly hacked a computer network used by the Senate Intelligence Committee as it prepared that report, which is said to criticize the CIA's use of waterboarding and other techniques. Then also today, we're getting a hint of how the White House will respond to the Senate report when it finally comes out, because the White House accidentally emailed a document to an AP reporter. In the document, the State Department heartily endorses the Senate's criticisms. AP intelligence writer Ken Delanian is with us from Washington. And Ken, you did not receive that email. A colleague did. But there's some poetic language from the State Department in it. So first, tell us more about how the State Department feels about the Senate report condemning the CIA.
They called this a story of which no American can be proud. And they essentially endorsed the very critical findings of this report, which accuses the CIA of misconduct, essentially. It says the CIA used methods that were far more brutal than previously understood and then misled Congress and the Justice Department about it.
And by the way, current and former CIA officials dispute that.
Oh, they absolutely do. Yeah. And so this has been a long-running saga pitting different parts of the government and former officials against one another. And it was interesting to see where exactly the State Department, at least in this document, is coming down.
Well, it not only says it's a story of which no American is proud, it goes on to say there's another part of the story of which Americans can be proud. What is that?
Right. You know, essentially that our democratic system worked, and I'm paraphrasing, and President Obama came into office and ended these practices.
What does the State Department say, though, about then-Secretary of State Colin Powell?
So this document asserts that Secretary of State Colin Powell was not initially informed, but that some ambassadors in the various countries where CIA black sites were located were told and then were instructed not to tell their superiors at the State Department.
So this State Department, the current State Department, is concluding that the Senate report is right on. Tell us about some more of those techniques. We mentioned waterboarding, but what else is the State Department talking about?
There's a list of approved techniques. They included slapping, humiliation, exposure to cold, sleep deprivation. I mean, waterboarding gets a lot of attention because it's near drowning, and most people agree that that is torture. But those other techniques, I've heard various officials say, you know, how bad could they really be? I mean, they're used against American troops sometimes in training. But what this report describes is a repetitive use of a variety of these techniques against detainees that, taken together, was extremely brutal. And in fact, the State Department said that the report leaves no doubt that the methods used to extract information from some terrorist suspects caused profound pain, suffering, and humiliation. And then it goes on to say it also leaves no doubt that the harm caused by the use of these techniques outweighed any potential benefit.
What does the State Department say, though, about whether there's any criminal charges here?
Well, it doesn't. That's outside of their purview. They have a question and answer part of these talking points where they expect reporters to ask that. And the answer is, you know, that essentially President Obama decided that no CIA officer who followed legal guidance from the Justice Department, however wrong that is now believed to have been, would be prosecuted. So then there was a criminal investigation into whether the CIA exceeded the legal guidance, and that investigation closed without charges. Now, some people think if this report is persuasive enough that the CIA, in fact, exceeded its legal guidance, some prosecutors may want to take another look.
Well, just a question, Ken, about the AP receiving this email at all. Again, a White House email that contained the State Department response to a Senate report condemning the CIA techniques after 9/11. And as you just said, it includes from the State Department questions that reporters are likely to ask, like should the Justice Department revisit its decision not to prosecute anyone? What was that like in the newsroom when you receive, by accident, this email saying what your questions might be about this case?
It was like just any other document that we maybe receive under a variety of circumstances. We looked at it, we saw that it was newsworthy, and we immediately began planning a story about it.
Do you think it was an accident?
We do think it was an accident. And we disclosed in the story that it came to us accidentally, but that's sort of all we've decided to say about it.
And how do you think this will be received, this news that the State Department is so behind the Senate report? There are many Republicans also who discounted the Senate's findings.
That's right. Most Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee opposed the findings, and there's a minority report from them. Many CIA officers, former CIA officers I talked to who were involved in this program will be very deeply disturbed that the State Department has endorsed this report that they find fundamentally flawed. And I think it puts the White House in an interesting position because the White House has been trying to balance President Obama's opposition to these techniques and the advocacy among many civil rights, civil liberties groups that want him to expose these techniques, which they believe were torture and were fundamentally wrong, with his reliance on the CIA, where there's some 200 people still working there who worked on this program and who feel like they're being sort of sold down the river. And President Obama is faced with having to balance how to react to this report in that context.
And he's relying on the CIA for his drone efforts.
Absolutely. Drones, gathering foreign intelligence. I mean, the CIA is playing a key role in his foreign policy in so many parts of the world.
Tricky line to walk. Ken Delanian, AP intelligence reporter. Thank you.
Robin, thanks for having me.
Well, now to Detroit, where today the city's mayor, Mike Duggan, is meeting with the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department to keep residents' water from being shut off at least for a couple more weeks. Detroit's policy is to give shut-off notices to people who are 60 days delinquent on their bills and owe more than $150. But that policy has drawn national outrage and has driven citizens into the streets to protest. Well, some people who live far from Detroit have stepped in to help with an initiative called the Detroit Water Project, which matches residents with outstanding bills to donors all around the country who want to pitch in. We're joined by Christy Tillman, who lives in Boston and co-founded the project with Tiffany Bell in Oakland, California. Christy, what inspired you to help?
Well, I've been following, and Tiffany and I have both been following the problems in Detroit. And there have been a lot of fundraising efforts in order to help the water crisis, but we weren't really sure where our money was going. A lot of the crowdfunding sources, you have to kind of raise a fund, right? And that takes time and effort. And we wanted to really find a way to give people immediate relief. Both Tiffany and I, we've both like been and have had hard times and kind of understand what it means to make trade-offs, what it means to kind of just really need like just someone just come in and help. So that was the main impetus for us. And we both wanted to pay a bill. I tweeted about that earlier, and Tiffany tweeted about it, and I saw it. I was like, yes, me too. You know, I just want to pay a bill. And so we went to the Detroit website, the water website, and we figured out that all you need is an account number to enter and that you could see the account information and that you could make a payment. So she and I tested that on one of the first people that kind of gave us their information.
Well, when you say that you've been through hard times before, what are you talking about?
What I'm talking about is I've had my own financial troubles just based in my own life. So I understand what it means to just need relief. And so that was kind of the empathy point that Tiffany and I both could understand what it means to just kind of help people immediately, no strings attached, and provide instant relief. We didn't want to do like a Kickstarter or a GoFundMe where you raise a pot of money and it takes 30 or 60 days. We wanted to do it really quick.
And at last count, you have more than 4,000 donors and climbing.
Yeah, we're like 4,500 now.
Wow. And how did you manage to get the word out?
So we both started on Twitter. It was like a Thursday when she and I just kind of were talking about it, and then we had a website up that weekend. But it's basically been social media, Twitter, Facebook, and that's about it.
And if you've got all those people donating, is it matching up to the demand for help paying water bills in Detroit, or are there still a lot more people that need help?
So there are a lot more people that need help, and one of the things that we're really focusing on now is reaching those people. So we have some on-the-ground efforts going on. We're looking at partnerships with a couple organizations. Tiffany, who's an engineer, is actually writing algorithms right now to automate everything. Hmm. And so once it's all automated, we can really focus all of our attention into actually building relationships with community organizations to get more people. I mean, we have a lot of people that need help. Last time I looked this morning, we had about 500 people on the list asking for help. And those bills range, right? They range from like 150 all the way up to into the thousands.
What's been the reaction from people in Detroit?
I've talked to people who we've helped already. So once we pay off the account, we actually call the person and let them know. So I've spoken. We have a volunteer that's helping, but Tiffany and I both have done the first calls because we just wanted, you know, the emotional connection. So the woman I spoke to was literally in tears, and like she thanked me and text messaged me a couple times, continuing to thank me. Like, it was a really very emotional response. Her bill was around $600, and we were able to get that done in a couple of days. So it's been really positive from people who've received help from us, from community organizations who have heard about us. So we're in the process of trying to work with some of those organizations to kind of double our efforts.
How long are you going to do this for?
So we have no plans to actually stop as long as there's a need in their donors, especially once we get the algorithms going so that everything is automated. It'll be a lot easier to maintain. So we don't have an end date in mind. As long as there's donors and people who need help, we'll continue.
And how many people do you have working with you?
I want to say about 8 people are helping us. So we have people helping us match. We have people who are going to Facebook and targeting certain Facebook sites to put our website there. We have people who call the Detroit residents and let them know their bill is being paid. So we have a small army of people who have been instrumental. My friend Jonica Reed, she has Detroit connections, and she's been connecting us with people locally, like churches, to help us get our name there.
Now, you and your partner on this project, neither of you are in Detroit. Do you have any plans to go? Are you going to move there?
So we don't have any plans to move to Detroit. We do want to go eventually and soon. So we've actually been talking about that. It would be nice to meet some people face-to-face. We care about the people there. And personally, I just thought it was horrifying, the fact that a city in our country would need to call the United Nations for water. To me, that's a low point for us. And so we just really care about the people in Detroit. And we both believe that water is a human right issue. So we don't feel like we need to be from Detroit to have an impact.
Christy Tillman, one of the co-founders of the project to help people in Detroit who are having trouble paying their water bills pay those bills. Christy, thank you so much and best of luck.
Thank you so much.
This week, the EPA is asking for public comment on its proposal to cut carbon emissions by 30% by 2016. It's called the Clean Power Plan, and the EPA says it's received nearly 300,000 written comments already. But this week in Atlanta, Denver, D.C., and Pittsburgh, thousands more are weighing in at hearings. Greg Schaefer testified this week in Denver. He works for Arch Coal, the country's second largest coal producer. After testifying, he spoke to Colorado Public Radio.
EPA has done a good job with these listening sessions, but I'm afraid they're not listening. So if they would try to engage the coal industry as opposed to trying to put them out of business, I think it'd go a long way with our ability to sit down with them and work in a joint manner.
Schaefer said the proposal would be a job killer, but Tom Hunt, who works for a solar nonprofit in Colorado called Clean Energy Collective, said it might actually help spur job growth.
We're an example of how policy that encourages clean energy in innovative ways allows for job growth and job creation and allows ideas that are started here in Colorado to spread across the country.
NPR's Jeff Brady is in Pittsburgh at the final EPA hearings of the week. So, Jeff, we know this is a big issue for the Obama administration. Tell us more about the plan the EPA put out last month.
Sure. These proposed rules, they're designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from existing U.S. power plants. And the goal is about 30%. The EPA is using 2005 for the baseline there. So the country has already made some progress toward that goal, but it still has a long way to go. And carbon dioxide is the main culprit that the agency is focused on here. The EPA has set specific targets for each state, so some will have more than 30% as their target, some will have less. Some of those big coal states that depend on coal-fired power plants are among those with smaller reduction targets. And states have some latitude in how they meet their target. They can encourage more conservation, increase renewable forms of electricity like wind and solar, upgrade coal plants, or replace them altogether with natural gas power plants. So that's kind of a quick summary of
right.
what these complicated rules would do.
Well, and as we just heard, people who back coal say that the plan will kill jobs. People who back clean energy, innovative new energy, say it will create jobs. What are you hearing today in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, we heard a lot of echoes of what we heard there at the top from the folks in Colorado. But I've also heard people in the coal industry point out that these proposed rules won't have a really big effect on climate change around the globe. They only apply. But environmentalists and the Obama administration counter that, saying, you know, but the U.S. has to lead here. And if the U.S. does lead, then a lot of those other countries will follow. And the coal industry also, you know, they focus a lot on the economic effects. The White House and environmentalists also like to point out that the country will save money by conserving more energy under these rules. So if you never use a kilowatt of electricity, pay it.
Yep.
The utility generated and the pollution isn't there.
Well, Jeff, we just have a little trouble with this technology we're using. Just say the critics say what, that it will not affect climate change because it only applies to what?
Well, it only applies to the U.S.
Right,
This is not reducing greenhouse gas emissions around the world, but the Obama administration and environmentalists say, well, somebody's got to lead here, and this is the U.S.'s job to do that. And so if the U.S. leads, the other countries will follow.
NPR's Jeff Brady at this week's EPA hearings in Pittsburgh. Standing on the steps there, Jeff, thank you. And you can comment on the EPA proposal until October 16th. We'll link you to instructions at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, the EPA is proposing another rule. This one would revise the Clean Water Act, and it's got farmers across the country riled up. From our Contributors Network, Chris Lehman of the Northwest News Network reports that depending on who you talk to, these revisions are either a land grab under the brute force of the federal government or a simple clarification of rules that ensure all Americans have clean water to drink.
Talk to just about anyone familiar with these proposed EPA water rules, and sooner or later they'll mention this YouTube video. It was put together by a Missouri farm family.
That's enough, no more power play.
If you're a parent, you probably know the Oscar-winning tune. It's from the Disney hit Frozen. But in this politically charged version, the lyrics urge the government to let it go when it comes to its proposed revision of the 1972 Clean Water Act.
Don't need more government anyway.
The Clean Water Act is the basic law that protects water bodies across the United States from pollution.
That's Nancy Stoner. She's the top water administrator at the Environmental Protection Agency. She says two Supreme Court rulings in the past decade muddied the waters when it comes to what's actually protected by the 40-year-old law, and that clarification is needed. But she says,
there's no new types of waters included.
Stoner says the EPA simply wants to spell out that the law covers all rivers and streams, including those that run dry during the summer, something more common out here in the West. That argument isn't swaying the critics, though. The American Farm Bureau has launched a campaign with a rallying cry of ditch the rule. That's because the Bureau believes the new rules could apply to ditches and even puddles.
That's kind of scary when you're a farmer.
That's Angela Bailey. She grows decorative trees and shrubs on land near Portland that's been in her family for nearly a century. As she shows me around her farm, she points to a low point that we're standing in. If we came here during a rainy winter, she says we'd be standing in water.
Yeah, but nothing really more than a puddle, by my estimation. You know, maybe, you know, at its worst, maybe water that comes up to my ankle.
Bailey says there are more than a dozen low places on her farm where water collects like this after heavy rains, and she says it typically evaporates or seeps into the ground. But she says she's not sure whether these normally dry spots would be subject to regulation under the new rules. If they are, that could mean costly and drawn-out environmental assessments and permits for any farm work done near these transient patches of water.
I do feel like there's a lot of uncertainty associated with the proposed rule.
We didn't change the definition of wetland.
That's the EPA's Nancy Stoner again. She reminds us that the revisions are only clarifying the rules to include the smallest streams, connected wetlands, and rivers that can dry up during the summer months.
Some of those are streams that flow seasonally or after rainfall events. Those are very important to protect.
Do these waters have to have a connection to the, you know, downstream flow? I mean, is that sort of the deciding point?
Absolutely.
So that would seem to rule out the now you see them, now you don't puddles on Angela Bailey's farm. But despite repeated reassurances from the EPA, agricultural advocates believe the government has something more up its sleeve. Oregon Congressman Kurt Schrader blasted the agency during a recent hearing on Capitol Hill.
This is ludicrous. I mean, I don't think anybody in a straight face can say that this is anything but a huge grab of jurisdictional power at the end of the day.
Schrader is a Democrat in an agricultural swing district. He's joined a largely Republican opposition to the new rules. These critics say it's more government intrusion into farming practices and control of what people can do with their own land. And they've drummed up so much of an outcry that the EPA was forced to extend its public comment period through October. In the meantime, congressional opponents of the EPA's rule change have vowed to take it to the House and Senate floor and simply overturn the new rules. It's not clear right now if they'd have the votes to do that. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Lehman in Salem, Oregon.
Today, Facebook launched a free mobile app in Zambia. The company says people who can't afford internet service in that poor African country will have a new way to find jobs or get health advice on pregnancy or childbirth. It is the latest in Facebook's Internet.org initiative, which is a larger push to reach millions of new customers in developing countries. Derek Thompson is here to tell us more. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Well, how does this app work exactly?
Facebook understands that although just 35% of the world has access to the internet, about 85% live in regions with cell coverage. So they have a plan to use cell coverage to take internet to these underserved communities, particularly in Africa. So first, you have to build the infrastructure. You need to build more cell phone towers to improve service. And second, you want to shrink the data to make it cheaper. And Facebook is using data compression and other technologies to make cheap internet that will flow from these cell phone towers to these phones. So if you're using the product in Zambia, what you've got is cheap access to kind of a little sliver of the internet that includes AccuWeather, Wikipedia, job search, as you mentioned, and, of course, Facebook's own app.
Yeah, and not Twitter, by the way. That is not one of the things that you can access. You can access Facebook, Messenger, Wikipedia, as you said, Google search. But so given the fact that they're not letting one of their chief competitors onto that system, is this altruism or is this just good business for Facebook?
Here's the way I think about it. The internet is the backbone of the new knowledge economy, as Mark Zuckerberg likes to say. But as many others point out, it's also the backbone of the Facebook economy. And maybe one day Facebook will get into the phone or coffee business. But right now, it is squarely in the business of getting people on Facebook and selling ads. So we can be cynical and we can say, oh, well, Facebook's only doing this because they think they can make money. And that might be true. But, you know, General Motors isn't building internet in Zambia. Starbucks isn't. And not to get too pie in the sky about this, but the nice thing about capitalism is that at its best, it channels selfishness for the greater good. So, yes, Facebook profits from the internet, but so does everybody. So Facebook's global hunt for profit and internet growth is, I think, to the tremendous advantage of millions of people who won't have access to it if Facebook doesn't start an initiative to build it.
But is there a lot of money to be made for Facebook by advertising in a country like Zambia?
Right now, probably not. But Facebook is being evaluated along a lot of different metrics. One of them is success on mobile. One of them is growth of monthly active users. Right now, you're not going to have a lot of mobile apps from companies like Coca-Cola and PepsiCo serve for a few million people. I think 3.5 million is the total possible right now in Zambia to be served for these new individuals. But at the same time, if what investors are looking at is potential growth of Facebook in these parts of the world that are going to learn about Mark Zuckerberg's company is essentially being equivalent to internet, the same way that a lot of us 10 years ago, 20 years ago, thought AOL was equivalent to internet. And that's a tremendous opportunity to begin to market to these developing communities in untapped areas like Africa.
Are the competitors to Facebook doing the same thing?
There's some companies participating in this project, like Ericsson, Nokia, Qualcomm, Samsung, that are working with Facebook to help spread really cheap internet to underserved communities. It should also be said that there are other companies that are trying to build this sort of Internet Zero project. You have Wikipedia has its own project called Wikipedia Zero, which is designed to give people Wikipedia access in countries with really low internet penetration too. Mm. So what you see is a lot of these companies that do want to make money, do want to stay afloat, but at the same time, they want to be seen as something more. And they're hoping that that advantage will not only have an altruistic element to it, but also potentially investors will like what they see in terms of that capitalistic altruism as well.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Congressman Eric Cantor officially steps down as House Majority Leader at midnight tonight. Earlier today, he gave his last speech on the House floor.
Walking into this building and walking onto this floor is something that excited me every day since I was first elected to Congress, as it should. Not one of us should ever take for granted the awesome honor and responsibility we have to serve our fellow Americans. This is a privilege of a lifetime.
Kenter will be replaced as majority leader by Kevin McCarthy of California after losing in that primary for his Virginia congressional seat. And his district is the focus of this week's District Profile. We're looking at congressional races across the country each week. Today, it's Virginia's 7th, where Republican candidate David Bratt, who defeated Kenter in the primary, will face Democrat Jack Trammell. Joining us to look at the race is Michael Pope, a reporter with WAMU in Washington, D.C., the newest member of the Here and Now Contributors Network. Michael, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, tell us about this district.
Well, the 7th Congressional District is an area that includes suburban Richmond. It stretches out into Henrico County. It includes kind of suburbs and exurbs going through Chesterfield, Orange, Rappahannock, Culpeper. It includes about 800,000 people. It's 75% white, and the area is pretty wealthy. The median income is $65,000. It's a storied congressional district because it's a seat that was once held by John Randolph, who later went on to be a famous Virginia senator. It was also held at one time by George Allen, who also went on to be a famous Virginia senator. So this is a very well-known area and a very important part of the state.
Well, let's get to the candidates. We, of course, remember David Bratt, who is a professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. He spoke on NBC 12 in Richmond about one of the issues that's most important to him. Let's listen.
The campaign is all about economics. I think the people watching know the deficits and the debt is up to $17 trillion. We have severe economic problems in the country, and the leadership on the Democrat side and on the Republican side won't even broach those issues.
So he's saying the campaign is all about economics. He has said he's a free market guy. What else should we know about David Bratt?
David Bratt is an economics professor at Randolph-Macon College. He is a native of Detroit. Very well educated. He has a master's in divinity from Princeton, as well as a doctorate in economics from right here at American University. He's been a professor at Randolph-Macon since 1996. He is somewhat new to the political scene. In 2011, he tried to become the Republican nominee for a House of Delegates seat that was unsuccessful. But then in 2014, of course, he had this stunning takedown of Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Now, David Bratt and his Democratic opponent, Jack Trammell, are both professors at Randolph-Macon College. Interestingly enough, at one time, they were teammates on a basketball team. So now they're playing on opposite teams, of course.
Yes, of course. And let's hear from Jack Trammell. He was interviewed on MSNBC's show, The Daily Rundown. He was asked about immigration reform, which he said he supports. Let's listen.
There are a lot of moving parts to immigration. We need to work across the aisle. But one part that's not moving is the House. And that's something I would like to change.
Tell us more about Jack Trammell.
Jack Trammell is also a professor at Randolph-Macon College. He's the director of disability services. As a fresh out of college teacher, he wanted to teach history, and he got a gig teaching special education. And ever since then, it's been very important to him. So he's now currently the director of disability services. He's also an associate professor of sociology and a prolific author. He has written more than 20 books. In fact, he apparently is currently working on a book about vampires, a book that he has put on hold as the campaign moves forward.
So, well, vampires can be popular with some people, but what are the issues that most people are worried about in the district?
So the issues that are likely to be part of the campaign are the same issues that were important during the primary. The importance of Wall Street, which this is sort of what you hear a lot in politics, sort of Main Street versus Wall Street. This is essentially how David Bratt was able to beat Eric Cantor, by positioning Cantor as the candidate of Wall Street, and Bratt positioned himself as the candidate of Main Street. So I would expect that we would see more of these economic issues take a center part of the campaign. Also, this issue of immigration. This is also what a lot of people believe sort of took Eric Cantor down, was the perception that he might be possibly in favor of some kind of comprehensive immigration reform. So I would imagine that that would also play a central role in the campaign as we move toward November.
Now, there has been a lot of attention on this race because everyone across the country saw the defeat of Eric Cantor. Has a lot of outside money come in to this race now between Bratt and Trammell?
We haven't seen a whole lot of outside money yet, but it's likely that we are going to as the campaign moves forward. In the most recent campaign finance numbers that came out, Bratt raised about $400,000. Trammell, by contrast, raised less than half of that, about $155,000. So what we've seen so far is Bratt has already started to enjoy some outside money. For example, the political action committee created by former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin made a contribution to the Bratt campaign. Trammell has not seen kind of outside money yet, but the thinking among many Democrats is that they want Republicans to pay for this seat. They want to put the Republicans on the defensive and make them spend money in this race. Even though this is largely a Republican seat, all of the national spotlight that you mentioned that's on this race might influence money being directed at Jack Trammell. We haven't seen that yet, but it's likely that we are going to as we move toward November.
What are the polls saying?
You know, I haven't seen actually any public polling in the race, but it's clearly a very Republican seat. If you look at the previous election history here of the 7th Congressional District, you'll see that in 2012, Romney won this congressional district with 57% of the vote. That's a pretty decisive victory here. So if you go back to 2008, McCain won this congressional seat with 53% of the vote. That was before redistricting, of course. Interestingly enough, redistricting made this congressional district even more Republican. And so what we see here is a race that is David Bratt's to lose.
That's Michael Pope of WAMU in Washington, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. Michael, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Today, the U.S. issued an advisory warning Americans not to travel to Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Guinea. More than 700 people in those countries have died from Ebola, which is spread through bodily fluids, blood, saliva, sweat, tears. Liberia's announced drastic measures to prevent the spread of the disease, closing schools, putting some government workers on leave, possibly quarantining entire communities. Some airlines have stopped flying to the affected countries altogether, while the U.S. has recalled 340 Peace Corps volunteers, and health workers are scrambling to find people who might have come into physical contact with Patrick Sawyer. Sawyer is the Liberian finance ministry worker whose sister died of Ebola. He then traveled from Liberia, stopped over in Ghana and Togo, and died last Friday in Nigeria. His next stop was supposed to be Minnesota to see his Liberian-American wife and three children who live there. And his now widow, DeConte Sawyer, has graciously come to Minnesota Public Radio to talk to us. DeConte, we're so sorry. That's so sudden.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I'm still in shock.
Yeah, I imagine so. So we doubly appreciate your coming to talk to us. What would you want us to know about your husband, Patrick? Why was he in Liberia?
Oh, Patrick was in Liberia because he felt like Liberia needed him. He was into social justice. Patrick was a community servant, and we both lived here in Minnesota, and he served the Liberian community here in Minnesota on a volunteer basis. Mm-hmm. That's how we met, in fact, volunteering for our cause in our community. And he wanted to go back to Liberia by all means, to help Liberia, to have a better democracy, because he had experienced it here in the U.S. And he wanted that for Liberia. He wanted social justice. He was huge into mental health. He felt very passionately about those things, and he wanted to be in Liberia to help make a difference.
So it's a loss for you and your three children, but also for Liberia, and for, as you mentioned, the Liberian community there in Minnesota. We understand it's one of the largest in the U.S., about 6,000 to 10,000 Liberians.
It's the largest in the world outside of Liberia. Huh. We have the largest Liberian community in the diaspora.
How has Patrick's loss hit your community there?
It's a big blow. Everyone knew Patrick here in Minnesota, in the Liberian community. So everyone feels like they've lost their best friend, their brother. And everyone's crying. Everyone's shocked. They're tired talking about it, pointing fingers, and they're tired saying, oh, it's the Liberians in Liberia. Because now it's hit home, and the Liberians here are ready to take action together as concerned Liberians against Ebola. And we have partnered up with Samaritan Purse and Global Health Ministries to help support those causes.
Well, a couple things there. The Americans in Liberia who are ill are with Samaritan's Purse, this aid organization.
Yeah.
And so you're now sending supplies to them. And you say it hit home. It wasn't just about Liberia anymore, but it almost literally came home. Your husband.
Literally. He was coming for the girls' birthday party. See, because of Patrick's passion and everything for Liberia, I was left here with three little girls to raise by myself. And I wanted Patrick back home. I told him, I didn't sign up to be a single mom. You need to come back and fight the good fight back home. Mm. So it put a strain on our marriage. But we deeply loved each other and loved our children. I scheduled the girls' birthday for August 16th. And told him the date, and he was coming. He was coming by all means. Nothing could have stopped Patrick from coming except Ebola.
Well, and there's such a sadness there, but also your fear that he could have come home with Ebola.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why I'm doing this, is that he could have come home with Ebola. I already have Ebola affecting one country of mine. I don't need it to affect another country of mine because I'm a U.S. citizen, too. And my daughters are here. And Mia, Bella, and Ava have friends in their schools. Yeah.
Well, we know the World Health Organization is not warning against flying, but some airlines have stopped flying, and we're hearing airports here are going to be screening for people coming in with
the
symptoms.
They're screening. It's interesting you mentioned that. I have an uncle that just arrived from Liberia to the U.S., and he called me this morning, and he said they screened them at the airports there in Liberia, because I was interested when he said he just came, and I said, are you okay? Did you let them know that you were in Liberia? And he said, yeah, they're screening us at the airport. I said, what are they screening for? And he said, well, the main thing is that if anyone has a fever, is running a temperature, they don't get to get on the plane from Liberia, because that's one of the earlier
signs. Did they rely on people to tell them?
No, they're testing.
They're testing. They're taking temperatures.
Yeah.
Well, does this lift your fear? Does this make you feel better?
Yeah. I'm not sure. With my uncle, he said he was approved to get on. But when he came, he turned himself in to the hospital and told them he came from Liberia. And he's actually been quarantined for the next 21 days.
Here in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Wow. So does this alleviate your fears, or do you want what some are calling for? Congressman Alan Grayson, the Democrat from Florida, proposed barring all citizens from the countries that have the outbreak, or any foreign nationals who've recently been to those countries. They shouldn't come in the U.S.
For how long?
Well,
because, I'm so confused, because there are people who went there who have families here, who went there just to visit, and they're dying to come back home to their babies. But yeah, we don't want them to bring Ebola back. I don't want that. But at the same time, if they're not displaying symptoms and they're being screened, I think they should be allowed to come back. We keep them there, their risks are higher of getting Ebola.
So you're conflicted. You know, this idea of barring flight would keep people that you know from having their loved ones come back or go to see them.
Well, I don't think anyone should go to see their loved ones in Liberia right now. I mean, I think if you're traveling there, it should be as part of a team that's going to help.
But you're conflicted about banning people from coming back because, I'm reading that Zuba Kapanaku, am I saying that correctly, who's chair of the Organization of Liberians in Minnesota, said his wife is there, and he wants her to come back.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. I want Patrick to come back. My daughters are going to never get to know the man I fell in love with, their father.
Oh, we're so sorry. What else do you want people here to know? I mean, are you worried that there will be a backlash against Liberians?
I hope not. Liberians are really fun people. No, it's not their fault. It's not their fault. It's like having a backlash at someone for having a mental illness or, you know, autism. Mia has autism. Could I share a poem I wrote?
Sure.
I think applies to this situation. It's one I wrote a long time ago about social justice, but everything about it applies to this right now. I was thinking about that on my way here. And it's called Don't Stand Back.
Go ahead.
Be my brother in my struggle. Don't stand back and watch while others lack the resources to resist the attack. It's what affects me, affects you. Together, we are bonded by this earth. So be my sister in my struggle, because what affects me does affect you, directly or indirectly. Don't stand back. Let's help. Thank you.
DeConte Sawyer, her husband Patrick, died of Ebola in Africa. She lives with their children in Minnesota. And DeConte, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. God bless you.